Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
When a teenage girl named Cora sets out to escape her life on a Georgia cotton plantation in Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, she is spirited out of the state on an actual train. This railroad is a mysterious network of tunnels that offer fugitive slaves a risky bargain. They can board any train that stops at the station they found their way to, but they can't know where that train is going or whether life at their destination will be better or worse. That's not how the real Underground Railroad worked, of course, but it is a fascinating metaphor for the hope and fear enslaved African Americans carried with them when they took the risk of running away. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Whitehead's novel won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for 2016 and raced to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. The book is now available in paperback, and Colson Whitehead joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Colson, welcome to Think.
How do you do? Thanks for having me.
So a lot of little kids first hear about the Underground Railroad and are really disappointed to learn that it's not a real thing, that the term is symbolic. Were you one of those kids?
I was. I remember being in fourth or fifth grade and hearing about it and thinking, oh, a subway like we have outside of the school building. And of course, that's not how it works. You know, we have a subway in New York that's like 7 miles long. We can barely keep that going. So 2,000 miles of track beneath America is pretty impractical.
When you decided to play with that concept for this book, what else did it unlock for you in terms of your ability to explore larger truths about racism and slavery without needing every single fact to line up with history?
Well, it's about 18 years ago, and I thought, what if I made the metaphor into a literal train? What kind of story could I get out of it? And then I added the element that each state that Cora, our protagonist, goes through is a different state of American possibility, like Gulliver's Travels. And so then 4 years ago, I sat down to write it, and that initial decision allowed me to do a lot of different things. It was not going to be a straightforward historical novel because the very concept was fantastic. And so it allowed me to sort of mix and match different periods in American history and European history and put them in conversation with each other. So not being tethered to what actually happened and, you know, the sort of historical novelist's job of getting it right, I was able to sort of make my own narrative about how America came to be.
Something that struck me from early in the book was the complex relationships that you build for your characters within the village of enslaved people on the Randall Plantation. First of all, there's a hierarchy, and people have so little that they have to fight for any little tiny thing to call their own. Cora is desperate to hold on to this tiny patch of garden that her mother and grandmother kept before her.
Yeah, I mean, and you're fighting for every, extra bite of food at breakfast to keep your strength up. And so you have so little, so everything becomes, so important. And, in writing in 2015, it seemed I couldn't stick to the pop cultural depictions of slavery. I think, in movies, we have an idea of a plantation where there are 100 slaves and one's like an Uncle Tom and everyone else is sort of helping each other. But from what we know about trauma and what violence and brutality does to your psyche, they're not all helping each other. They're not post-traumatic. They're enduring this trauma every day of their lives. And so it seemed I had to make a psychologically credible plantation. And so there's a lot of violence and brutality among the slaves. They're fighting for extra food, for that extra little bit of land that they can call their own. And they're damaged, and I felt it was my my job to have a real plantation.
Yeah, like one of the most insidious things about this, I think everyone is familiar with the brutality and the injustice of being worked literally to death in most cases. Slaveholders make it impossible to stick up for someone else because it not only puts the defender at risk, it makes things worse for the original victim.
No, and one of the things that happens early on is that Cora does stand up for a boy who's getting beaten, and it's such a rare thing to do. It's very dumb. She ends up paying a terrible price for it. But you know, they had systems of keeping folks in line. You know, if you have 100 slaves and one runs away, when that slave is captured, you cut off their feet, as an example. You have, you know, these sort of public punishments where all the slave quarter, the slave village can witness what will happen to them if they transgress. You know, there are millions of people in bondage, and how do you keep them in line through, you know, terrible acts of sadism?
So Cora's mother, Mabel, has been gone since she was a girl, having escaped in the night without ever saying goodbye. Cora maybe should be happy that she got away, but all she can think of is that she was left abandoned. She's effectively a stray among the enslaved people on this plantation.
Yeah, I mean, and that abandonment, you know, shapes so much of her psychology. On the one hand, her mother is a symbol of someone who escapes, a symbol of heroism. I mean, it takes heroism to stay in a plantation also, you know, protect your children and try to save them from the worst of the punishments. But she's a symbol of flight and also a symbol of someone who's, you know, really ruined her life. She's left at 10 or 11 years old to her own devices in this terrible plantation. And so, you know, those twin ideas about her mother really determine so much of her psychology and how she acts through so much of the book.
So Cora has been relegated to this cabin that's called the Hob. Talk about who lives there.
The misfits and outcasts. You know, I was trying to create a plantation that made sense to me. And what do we do with our damaged people, the people who can't obey by society's rules? We send them to institutions. We send them far away. And so the Hob cabin is the home of the sort of misfit women, the strong women, the people who have been also psychologically damaged and can't necessarily work as much as they used to. And so they have their own sort of separate community in the larger plantation, which, you know, to me makes sense. That's how we treat people today. And that's how that sort of self-sorting went on in the plantation.
When these ideas came to you, you know, that the sort of stereotypical narrative of everybody sticking together among the enslaved people, when you realized that probably wasn't emotionally true, I wonder what that felt like to you as an African-American.
Well, I mean, you know, the hard part, the emotionally hard part of the book was doing the research and then realizing what I'd have to put on the page to be realistic, what Cora would have to go through in order to be realistic and the supporting cast. And then also realizing that, you know, it's a miracle I'm here, you know, that this or that ancestor wasn't killed at this or that juncture on the Middle Passage while being kidnapped, while being transported from plantation to plantation, and they had a child who survived and had a child. And so, you know, coming to the research as a grown-up as opposed to, say, a kid watching Roots, I did have a more adult reckoning with the material, and that was hard. Once I started writing, you know, it was, you know, the work makes it separate. You know, I'm creating something, and if I was in that kind of anguish every day, I wouldn't be able to produce, you know, hopefully a cohesive work of art.
Was there anything in those first-person accounts that you found that surprised you that you just hadn't considered before?
Well, there's you know, it comes out in the tone of the book, you know, that the violence is very matter-of-fact.
Yeah.
And going through slave narratives or first-person accounts of former slaves, they describe the most extreme piece of brutality without adorning it. They have to sell it to the listener because it spoke for itself. And so that became part of the book. A lot of the language, you know, I came across the phrase Negro cloth a couple times. And so there's this really, really low quality form of fabric that was only fit for clothing slaves, and they call it Negro cloth. And so this whole language out of the system arises that they used, and it's very, very alien to us, but makes sense. And then, you know, for me, becomes the stuff that makes the book real.
You know, it's such an interesting detail for you to have highlighted in the book, too, because there's a point at which Cora is given a dress that is not made of this Negro cloth. It's just cloth. Like, I thought about the texture on her skin and what it felt like, and, like, on top of all the other discomforts, it's such a small thing, but, you know, something that's chafing at you all throughout the day is just agonizing, and yet it's such a tiny little thing compared to everything else.
Well, I mean, You know, part of the work is putting yourself into your characters' heads, whether it's an elevator inspector in my first book or somebody surviving a zombie apocalypse in my novel before this one. And so, you know, I'm always trying to just figure out those small emotional moments, the small physical details. What's it like? And of course, I grew up in the very comfortable 20th century America, and projecting myself into the daily discomforts, humiliations, and deprivations of a slave is hard, and it's also, you know, what you sign up for when you write any kind of book, but definitely a historical novel. Getting rid of your modern perceptions and trying to step out of yourself.
Well, you mentioned you started thinking about this story like 18 years ago, and I know you've said in other places that you didn't feel like you were ready right away. What were you learning to do in the years between the time you first had the inspiration and the moment you thought, okay, I'm ready to do this thing?
I didn't know what I learned until I actually started writing. You know, I felt the idea was great, but I didn't feel I was I had enough mastery of my craft to pull it off. And so I would finish a book and then, you know, pull the idea out and think, am I ready? And the answer was always no. But there are moments when I was writing, and I was, you know, it was very apparent to me that Colson of 15 years ago or 10 years ago would have done something very different. You know, there's a Natural History Museum in the South Carolina section, and it's two pages describing Cora as an actor in this living sort of diorama. And it was two pages, and I was done. And I realized that, you know, old Colson, you know, would have gone on some 20-page postmodern riff on who's the curator, what's his philosophy, and how this museum came to be. I was very controlled as I was going through and realizing that there are things that worked for me 15 years ago that don't work for me now, that interest me now, but hadn't occurred to me, you know, years before. And so I felt ready. I've been putting it off for so long that it seemed I had no choice but to do it. And not to sound like too self-helpy, but the book I've been avoiding was the one I should do. And it wasn't until I, you know, page by page, I was like, oh, you know, it was worthy of waiting for.
It's funny that you say it's only two pages, because since reading the book, those scenes are the ones I have thought of over and over. And they made me think a lot. So these are kind of like sanitized tableaus of what the white curator imagines the black experience would have been like, right? In the Middle Passage and in slavery. And it made me think a lot about the history textbooks that I was given as a child. Nobody was saying slavery didn't happen, but it was just sort of something that was mentioned as opposed to really explained to us. You know, we weren't necessarily encouraged to identify with the way these people suffered as fellow Americans.
No, I mean, I think, you know, we learned there were slaves and also indentured servants who were white, you know, and I think, you know, I feel that we'll do 10 minutes on slavery and then 40 minutes on Abraham Lincoln and then skip to, like, you know, the really sort of affirming parts. And the museum section is a way of talking about how we receive history and how history is taught. And it's also a moment for Cora to gain some agency. You know, she starts off as a piece of property and she's moving north, but also into personhood. And so even though she's uneducated, she can critique the window display of life in the plantation. That's not how it worked for her. And so how do I show the education of someone who can't read, who's never been to school? It's through, you know, her lived experience. And that moment's important for me to have her come into herself.
My guest is novelist Colson Whitehead. He won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for The Underground Railroad. That book is out now in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or join us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Colson Whitehead. His book, The Underground Railroad, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. It's out now in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Colson, the fact that Mabel eluded recapture means that Cora is not the only one obsessed with finding her. The bounty hunter Ridgway cannot let go of the fact that he failed to track her down. He's really terrifying, and I think it's because he seems in control most of the time. Like, he's casually murderous. He's not always ranting and raving. Talk about what you thought about when you decided what sort of person he would be.
Well, he's a slave catcher, so his job is to capture runaway slaves and take them back to their master for a bounty, and so he's the heavy for most of the book. And I want a really strong antagonist for Cora, who's, you know, similarly very strong. And it took me a while to figure out how he walked and talked. I knew I wanted him to articulate philosophies about white supremacy and manifest destiny and imperialism. And when they finally get together, you know, it's in Tennessee, and I sort of pictured it as a stage. It's in the book, it's been ravaged by wildfire and yellow plague, and I sort of pictured it in my head as sort of Waiting for Godot, these two people sort of debating existence on this wasteland. And so I had a hard time figuring him out, and what helped me was Eric Foner's book on the Underground Railroad called Gateway to Freedom, and it deals with New York and the sort of spy versus spy warfare between abolitionist lawyers and slave catchers in the New York City court system. And I like writing about New York. I'm from New York, and I was kind of depressed I couldn't get New York into the book because it takes place in the South. And then I realized, oh, maybe he comes to New York, and that's where he sort of enters into his mature slave-catching identity, you know, as part of this the spy versus spy game. And so I finally figured out how he walked and talked, but it took a while, definitely.
What's really chilling about him is that I think if you were to ask him, he would say it's not personal. It's literally not personal, to the extent that when he has recaptured someone, he refers to them not by he or she, but by it. And it's like he thinks of himself as a defender of property rights.
Well, I mean, that's what they thought, and slaves were property. They were not human beings under the law. They were objects, and so he embraces that. You know, he's upholding white supremacy. If a white man can hold on to it, then it's his by sort of divine right. Slavery is the capitalist grease that keeps America going. And if a slave escapes, then the system crumbles. And so he's himself as a preserver of the order.
Hmm. When Cora and Caesar, the person she runs away with, arrive at the first depot of the Underground Railroad, they wonder about who built it, and they ask, but they don't really get an answer. And this happens multiple times. And I think I felt as a reader like I was left wondering, too, until it became clear that this thing, this railroad that in your book is a physical thing, was built by every successful passage to safety.
I mean, it's a physical tunnel. It's an idea. It's freedom itself. Now that 2 years have passed, and I can sort of talk about it more abstractly than how I was putting it on paper. And again, you know, I think if I'd written it 10 years ago, I would have shown the building of the tunnel, and I would have shown the workers and the people who decided the right of way. And you know, what's important is Cora's moving Cora from place to place to these alternative Americas, and not so much the tunnel or how she gets there, but the new world that she goes to. And so when I was writing, you know, the tunnel, the Underground Railroad itself seemed the least interesting thing about the whole project.
What is it like to undertake a project that doesn't seem like anything else you've written before? You know, you mentioned that you've written stuff about the zombie apocalypse, and you've done some just sort of wilder things. What did it take for you to say, yeah, this is absolutely the kind of book that Colson Whitehead writes?
Well, I mean, the premise made total sense to me. You know, for years I would tell my friend, it always makes sense to me if I can't articulate it. And so for years I would say, oh, this crazy idea, you know, it's alternative America. And people would say, oh, that sounds really dumb, Colson. And then I started saying, like Gulliver's Travels, and that, you know, gave them something to pin it onto. But you know, it's Gulliver's Travels, it's the Odyssey, you know, a hero on a series of allegorical adventures, moving from, you know, place to place. But, you know, it's hard to figure out these new forms, you know, the pseudo-historical novel that this book is, a zombie novel, a coming-of-age novel I did about 10 years ago. I like doing the same thing over and over again, and if I can do a certain kind of book, why do it again? And then the challenge of figuring out why I like stories about the apocalypse. How can I make them work for me? What do I dislike from the tradition? What do I want to keep, throw out? And that stuff is hard, but also, you know, makes those first 100 pages very vital and, you know, exciting.
Caesar is driven to educate himself despite the dangers inherent in being caught reading. His sense, though, is that if he can read, he's not really a slave, and if he's kept from reading, he is.
You know, it was against the law to teach slaves how to read. If you can read a book, read about the world, you're not a slave anymore. You're a human being with the whole world at your fingertips. And so definitely you could be beaten if you're found holding a book. If you're a white person teaching a slave how to read, you could be beaten or fined because it was powerful. And so it's always a big moment in a slave narrative when the narrator, the person who's telling their story of escaping from bondage, finally gets that first book or that first teacher who's teaching them illicitly their letters. And it's true for Caesar, who's Cora's accomplice in the book. And it's true for Cora, you know, when she gets an almanac, that's her gateway to the world. It's, you know, a little portable Wikipedia of how you dress and how you farm and the moons and the tides and the oceans. And so and suddenly, you know, the whole world is hers.
The first place they end up together is, I think, South Carolina, which at first seems like a kind of utopia compared with enslavement. Black people aren't equal to white people or even allowed much autonomy, but it appears they can live decent lives as long as they follow all the rules. And pretty soon it becomes very clear that what they imagined as better is not good enough and, in fact, is really toxic.
Yeah, slaves in South Carolina are freed. You know, they're given housing and jobs and education. There's sort of programs for this, sort of in an echo of 1960s Great Society programs. But if everything turned out great, it'd be a much shorter book. So they're about 20 pages before things start going terrible again.
At what point you describe a room full of chains that they come on? Some of them are huge. They're obviously impossible to break, these chains that have kept people enslaved. Some of them, and this was the part I found really interesting, some of them are really delicate. They seem like they wouldn't be hard to break, but they're chains nonetheless. And that's a really interesting metaphor to describe the experience of people held in slavery. From a distance, it may have seemed that some were worse off than others. Surely they were physically, but they were all enslaved.
No, I mean, yeah, when she gets to South Carolina, her life is materially better, and she does have a house, and she goes to a schoolhouse, she gets a paycheck. But there are different kinds of bondage, different ways of being enslaved, and that, you know, that page about the room full of change, I think, sort of coalesces that. And as she goes from South Carolina to North Carolina to Indiana, she does get acquainted with these different forms of freedom, these different kinds of chains that are imposed upon you and that you impose upon yourself.
So this book is definitively not about white saviors shepherding black people to safety. When Cora arrives in North Carolina, she's taken in by this really deeply reluctant helper who hides her away in an attic, but he's mostly afraid that he and his wife will be killed. So at that point, she's technically free, but she's more a prisoner than ever before.
Yeah, I mean, she's taken in by Martin, who's sort of reluctant to work on the railroad, and he sort of inherited the business from his father, unfortunately for him. And he's married to a woman named Ethel who, you know, doesn't want to get killed and suffer the punishments of harboring runaway slaves. And there are saintly people who help slaves escape. There are people who did it for money. You know, if you have the money, I'll take you in my boat up the coast to New York. And then there are a lot of people like Ethel who have no opinion about slavery at all. They are wrapped up in their own sort of personal drama. And I think that's a lot of people. A lot of white folks back then didn't necessarily lose a lot of sleep over slavery, the same way that we now might not think about Syria or the homeless encampment at the edge of our town. We're busy with our own sort of daily misery and disappointments and hopes. And so, the book reboots every 60 pages, and it allows for a much bigger cast and a much more complicated cast than, you know, maybe a straightforward historical novel.
The scenes where Cora is hiding in this attic, of course, remind us of Anne Frank and Hitler's final solution to what he called the Jewish problem. It's in some ways like an alternative vision of how America could have manifested its deep racism by creating a world in which, you know, just people were systematically executed.
Yeah, in North Carolina, in my version of North Carolina, this alternative North Carolina, they have a solution to the Negro problem. And it's killing any black person who steps foot in the state. And, one of the big famous slave narratives was written by a woman named Harriet Jacobs. And she writes about hiding in an attic, you know, supposedly for 7 years. And, you know, when I was conceiving of the book, you think hiding in an attic, you think Anne Frank. And that becomes an opportunity to open up the discussion the book is having about oppression. Nazi doctors and Nazi theoreticians got their ideas of race purity and eugenics from 19th century American scientists. We invented that stuff, and they took it to its logical extremes. The Jim Crow laws in the South, lynching culture, was taken to a logical extreme by the Nazis. And so, by not sticking to what actually happened, I can bring in Europe in the 1930s and 1940s and put what actually happened in against what could have been here.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Colson Whitehead. We're talking about his book, The Underground Railroad. It's available now in paperback. When you put Cora in the attic, she is overlooking this public park where they have this kind of ritual hanging of black people who are caught within the borders of North Carolina. And it's so strange because she's watching this whole scene of people who have come to see this kind of brutality as a form of entertainment. And I wonder what you wanted us to think about.
Well, I mean, it was entertainment. You know, you would tell folks in town that you're going to lynch this guy, a black guy you have in custody, and you'd bring grandma, you'd bring little Sue, your granddaughter, your daughter. And the whole town would watch this guy being hung, this guy being buried alive. And a lot of the, some of the earliest photography in America was on postcards of lynchings. And you would, send a picture of a lynching. The whole town is there. A guy's burned alive. And send it to your cousin in Ohio. Wish you were here. And so in my book, it's a weekly thing. And lynchings are not weekly. But in my book, they're wrapped in with a minstrel show and some music and saying, not too subtly that, this brutality was a form of entertainment and it was regular and people had no problem taking it in.
It's a little hard to get there mentally. You know what I mean? Like, it was not that long ago that this sort of thing was commonplace. It's hard to imagine what has changed in our culture, and we certainly aren't in a place where everything is good now. But the thought of sending a postcard to your cousin of someone being lynched is just hard to understand.
You're a black person in the wrong place at the wrong time, and blamed for a crime, and you're killed. And you can, we have a renewed discussion about police brutality, but you can be shot in the back 8 times, like Stephon Clark, in your own backyard, unarmed. And it happens every week, and it's part of Black life, and it's part of American life.
You also touch on things like forced sterilization in this book. The techniques that you talk about, you know, were not available at the time of the events of the novel were taking place, but you're sort of taking us, in some ways, you're just in, you know, 300 years of history all at once. And at first, Cora's not sure what people are referring to when they're talking about their babies being taken away.
Well, I mean, we had a program of forced sterilization in the late 19th century and part of the 20th century, where we sterilized the so-called feeble-minded immigrants, poor people of color, to prevent them from having babies and being a burden on the state, on the higher level of scientific racism, to get their genetic stock out of circulation. So that actually happened. And how does that attitude towards black people's bodies relate to the attitude towards black people under slavery? How can I put these two different moments that are separated by time and then tie them together so that we can see those linkages? What has changed and what stayed the same but changed form?
So I don't think Abraham Lincoln's name appears in this book at all, but I wonder what you do with his legacy. This person who, on the one hand, is credited with like helping to free enslaved people in America, and on the other hand, someone who believed that blacks and whites would never be able to live peacefully in the same communities.
I don't think much about Lincoln, but of course, abolitionists are motivated by different reasons. They may think it's immoral to have people in bondage, but also think that the Negro race is inferior. You can hold those two ideas in your head at the same time. And so that sort of complication, I think, is part of racism. It's part, you can hate a Mexican and love black people. You can hate brown people of a certain kind and like other brown people. And that's the kind of insanity of our innate impulse towards hatred.
My guest is writer Colson Whitehead. We're talking about his 2016 The Underground Railroad, which won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award and is now out in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Colson Whitehead. His book, The Underground Railroad, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. It's out now in paperback. If you want to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter and ask a question at @KERAThink. More than once in this book, Colson, Cora has companions who could become lovers. They could be life partners. We're reminded of how dangerous it must have been to allow yourself to fall in love with someone when you weren't allowed to control your own life.
Yeah, I mean, I just had a lot of terrible experiences on the plantation, her mother's abandonment, various other things, and it shapes your idea of who you are. You know, that trauma shapes your idea of who you can have in your life, what you want for yourself, your idea of love and what you're capable of allowing into your life. And so, you know, as she goes state to state, all that stuff that happens in Georgia in that first chapter, of course, ripples through her lives. And you know, some of her companions don't make it, you know, and that was the fact of that sort of enterprise. If you were caught, you'd be put to death, and she's with people, and then not all of them are with her at the end.
Why choose a woman to anchor this story?
There are a couple of reasons. I had a string of male protagonists. I just didn't want to do the same crap all the time. Try to mix it up, confuse people. And then, I mentioned Harriet Jacobs, who wrote a very famous slave narrative, and she writes about the predicament of the female slave. When a slave girl becomes a slave woman, she enters into a new, more terrible form of slavery. She's now subject to her master's sexual desires, if she was not already. Because the economics of the plantation, she's supposed to find a partner and pump out babies, because more babies means more money, more slaves, more property. And it just seemed that I was worthy of exploring and taking up.
Toward the end of the story, Cora makes her way to a farm that is owned and run by a prosperous black family. First, she's faced with the question of whether there is room for more people in this place where black people are thriving.
Yeah, I mean, for many years I had these sort of thumbnail descriptions of the state. So white supremacist state. And in Indiana, where Valentine Farm is, it was black utopia state, ? And I was trying to figure out what the sort of best case scenario for someone like Cora would be. And so these people have come from the East Coast. They set up a sort of self-sufficient community. They take in runaways, and you can stay or move on. But of course, they're just always afraid of the white communities that are sort of sprouting up down the road. And as happened in many different times, there are black towns that got successful, and then they were raided by white posses and razed, burned to the ground. Taken over for their mineral wealth or whatever sort of industry they'd set up. And so it's precarious. And she has found this place that is, on the one hand, utopia, but also, given the fact that it's America in 1850, is also very precarious.
There's a deep divide among the residents there. Should they be patient and sort of work incrementally? Should they take immediate action to protect what's theirs regardless of the backlash? Who's worth the investment of preparation for the future, and who is maybe better left to struggle on their own so that they don't drag everybody down? It's a window into a lot of different conflicting narratives that I think we're still grappling with.
Yeah, I mean, in the 19th century, you have Booker T. Washington and Du Bois and Frederick Douglass articulating conservative, progressive ideas of what's next for the black race. And definitely, the arguments of someone like Booker T. Washington echo in some of the things you hear today. Can we save slaves who have been so damaged by their bondage and bring them up with us into the next stage of where the black race is going? Can we save communities that have been ravaged by drugs and poverty and crime and take them onto this next place that where black America is going to in 2018? And so all the, sadly, I'm not sure if it's sad or not, but all those arguments continue to echo, and they never get solved, and we just continue sort of to just sort of stumble through trying to, continue to try to figure out what's next.
Well, it's interesting to me because it seems like we all know that the right answer is yes, everybody is worth saving, every human life is valid. And then at the same time, there's this question of how you get there, and that's the thing nobody can answer.
And I certainly cannot. So.
I imagine that this book is being read widely in schools at this point. Are you confident that every reader understands that this is, that you've taken a lot of liberties with the history here? Did you have any concerns about that at all?
No, I mean, on the cover, it does say The Underground Railroad, a novel. That's like one indication that it's a fictional story.
No, I get it.
There's a page, on page 74, there's a literal train underneath the earth. That's another indication that there's fantastic element. I've been told that people have, gone to the internet to look up, when did forced sterilization happen? Did it happen? There was a medical experiments on black folks in Tuskegee. When did that happen? And so it has sent people to do different research, and I think in high schools where it's being taught now, because the book does rove so widely over these different periods, it provides for a lot of different examinations of stories about America that aren't taught or aren't taught very deeply. But it's not my responsibility to have an ideal reader who's up on everything. You know, I think the book works on its own terms. And if it does, you know, send people to the internet, that's fine by me.
Now, well, of course, they have to, like, go with a little bit of caution to the internet for information as well sometimes. But what kind of reader were you as a student? Like, were you reading the sorts of books that you wrote earlier in your career? Were you reading history and historical fiction?
I read a lot of science fiction and horror. So Stephen King, you know, my parents would buy the annual Stephen King book, and it would come to my sister's room and then me and my brother's room. And love television, you know, love The Twilight Zone, love comic books. And it seemed when I was a kid that writing, you know, the X-Men or Spider-Man would be a great gig if you're a writer. Being a writer, you could work from home. You didn't have to talk to people, and you just make up stuff all day. And so that's when I wanted to be a writer, you know, when I was in seventh or eighth grade.
So the thought of having a gigantic project that takes years to complete, frankly, terrifies me. And, you know, like I can only get stuff done by having a deadline every day. How do you manage the years when you're researching and writing?
Well, I mean, you know, hopefully I'm not teaching and I have like 9 months free where I can write. And I try to do 8 pages a week, which adds up. Mm-hmm. And I don't do anything else. I'm not writing another book on the side or writing essays. I'm only doing that. And so, you know, making progress week by week. And then when I'm done, I'm off. You know, I just watch TV and read and play video games and cook food for my family and don't think about work at all. So I'm sort of on for like a year, and then I'm off for like a year or a year and a half, and it, you know, it seems to work.
Is it strange to be still, I don't know how many interviews you're doing now with the paperback tour, but to be sort of deeply engaged in talking about this book that you've been, I guess, effectively done with for 2 or 3 years now, right?
I like the book, you know.
Sure.
You know, people say have asked me, are there any questions you're sick of getting? And it's pretty much only the racist ones. Yeah, pretty much anything else is pretty much fine. You know, I realize that what happened with this book in terms of it being embraced by readers and critics and all sort of good things happened with you know, the Pulitzer and things like that. Sort of a once in a lifetime. Sort of constellation of good news. And so I'm glad the book is out there and people dig it. I've written books where no one really cares, and after a week, no one wants to talk to me about it. So, you know, I'm very fortunate, and, you know, I'm happy to go out there. And
you're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Like, when you get racist questions, are they dumb, ignorant racist questions, or are they really malicious racist questions?
Really malicious. I mean, you know, it came out in Europe, and so, you know, I've met Americans who still think that the railroad was a real railroad.
Like adult Americans.
Adult Americans, and that's sad. And then, of course, in Europe, they have even less grounding in American history, so it's more understandable. But I get sort of stuck in this mode of ask a black guy a random question, like opportunities to ask black guy
like I've always wondered, yeah.
So, yeah. Why is Barack Obama black when he has a white mom and was raised by white people? That was a couple times in Europe. You know, you grew up in New York, so I guess you haven't experienced racism, because I guess there's only racism in the South. You know, it's racism based on your race, not, you know.
Not where you live. Yeah.
So that's draining, and you do a lot of explaining about how race works in America. But then also, you know, say in France and in Poland, which had a resistance against the Nazis, they would connect the underground railroad workers with the French resistance. You know, getting people to safety, subverting this oppressive power. It's traveled. The book has traveled in China and in Russia, and I think that power dynamic between master and slave, whether it's royalty and peasants, aristocracy and serfs, you know, that power dynamic just translates to some, beyond America. It's so much of history around the world. And so, so you know, it's surprising to see the connections people make. And then also, just like, what are you guys talking about? Barack Obama, what? You know?
Do you ever just say to somebody, I'm not going to answer that. That's a ridiculous question.
Yeah, I do. And then... I'm sort of surprised I get away with it. I guess I'm always trying to be polite and try to explain and be patient. And then when I do sort of, you know, sort of shake my head and say no, people just go on to the next question, like unfazed, like whatever, okay.
Are there things in the book that that readers or reviewers have taken away that you didn't intend for them to take away from it?
There's a scene which apparently is... parallels the parable of the Good Samaritan in the Bible, which I've not actually read. You know, I've read parts of the Bible, and I've read, you know, for this book, went back to parts that deal with slavery. And so, you know, at Q&As, people have said, oh, and in this character, is this, you know, how's this related? And they have this long explanation of how it's actually, the end of the book is actually this summation of the Good Samaritan. And I'm like, I can't help you there. But thanks for reading to the end. You know. Happy to sign your book.
Who's the first person you call when you win a Pulitzer Prize?
Yeah.
Is it that kid from college that always thought he was better than you, or like?
My wife was there, and so we started hitting the rosé pretty quickly. It was like 2 in the afternoon. And then my mom and, you know, my family, and then I had a lot of friends in town, so just happened to be that case. And so we met at a bar and started having burgers and fries and beers, and it was a really nice day.
I'm sure this is an annoying question, and I'm sure you've been asked it a million times, but following up something that people call an American masterpiece is a little daunting. So what do you do with that?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been working on another novel, and all the good things that happen doesn't make it easier. It's always sort of hard. I'm always sort of miserable. You know, this book was hard because I was broke and depressed. This book was hard because I was broke, depressed, and something else is going wrong. So they're always sort of difficult. With this one, the travel is sort of interfering with getting work done. But that's, you know, that's the way it goes with work. And in terms of, you know, my career, I gained people with my book Sag Harbor, a realistic coming of age story about growing up in the 80s, and I lost them with zombies. You know, people, I hate zombies, and then. I gain readers with this, and I'll lose readers with the next one. So I'm used to disappointing people. I do it in my books. I do it in my personal life. And so I take that as my reality and just go with it.
Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. You can get it in paperback now. Colson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
No, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Any podcast app will have the Think podcast. You can also find a stream of the show at think.kera.org, where you can check out what we have coming up and look at years worth of archives of Think broadcasts. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.